is The Unseen, and I'm your host, Mike Cleland. For this episode, I am very happy to be talking with my friend Timothy Renner. Timothy is an author, artist, musician, podcaster, and researcher who is mostly focused on Bigfoot and mostly focused on his home state of Pennsylvania. During this episode, we talk a lot about Bigfoot and all the strange outlying stuff that surrounds Bigfoot, stuff like synchronicities, poltergeists, haunting, ancient folklore, and the modern UFO contact experience. And we also talk about why does the researcher become part of the research? And we will offer up no answers here, just a lot of unanswerable questions. Timothy has written and illustrated 4 books, and the latest is titled Don't Look Behind You. It is subtitled Following Ghost Roads into the Unknown. And that is a follow-up to his 2016 book Beyond the Seventh Gate, which is a great title in my opinion. And that one is subtitled Exploring Toad Road, the Seven Gates of Hell, and Other Strangeness in York, Lancaster, and Adams Counties. He also hosts a weekly podcast, Strange Familiars, and I recommend this show in the strongest possible way. It is amazing. Now, we went on a bit long, so I'm talking fast here in this intro, and I want to keep it a little bit short. But before we start the show, I need to point out that at a few points, Timothy mentions an excellent podcast titled Where Did the Road Go?, hosted by our friend Soraya. And this was how Tim and I met. We were both guests on that show and did a roundtable discussion on the overall weirdness that seems to invade this kind of research. This conversation was recorded on Sunday, October 27th, 2019. Please enjoy. Tim, I want to thank you so much for doing this interview. It means a lot to me.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mike.
You're very welcome. Hey, you have been immersed in paranormal research for a while, and you have a podcast, which is amazing, called Strange Familiars. And we'll talk about that shortly. But before we do anything, I just want to say I met you in April and we were at a conference and it was a wonderful conference. I think I want to be careful what I say. I think there were more presenters at the conference than there were people in the audience. So it was a bummer on one sense, but it was all basically either my friends or my new friends. It was a really fun scene to hang out in.
It was an excellent conference. That the fact that there weren't more people there, you know, they don't know what they missed, really. Like, the presenters were, and remove me from that equation, the presenters were top-notch.
I agree, absolutely, yeah. Yes, and then after the conference, you, me, Joshua, my partner Andrea, and Jack and Suzanne, we all went over to Jack and Suzanne's house, and they have a big coffee table, and we sat around the coffee table, and Suzanne pulled out a bunch of forks and spoons. And I had Joshua tell this story just of 2 weeks ago, and I want you to how did that go for you? What was, you know, it seemed so casual as it was happening. And in afterwards, I was like, holy crap, that was a big deal.
Yeah. When we started just messing around with those, so I thought these are going to be very flimsy utensils. Right. When she's talking about bending spoons or bending forks and so forth. So what's the trick here? You know, these are going to be very flimsy utensils. She brings them out and they're quite hard to bend. You know, I was sitting there like messed around with them. And she said the trick is to get out of your own head. And it's literally we would just sit around and talk. And eventually you get out of your own head and you bend these things. I don't know how much of that is psychic power and how much of that is literally just getting out of the way of yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, so you take the spoon and I had a fork and I am certain I could have bent it if I like grit my teeth and it would have hurt my hand to bend it.
Right.
It was that kind of, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to bend it the way it's shaped right now. And Yeah, she kind of said, okay, just rub it, do the little thing, put a little intention in it, touch the spot where you want to bend, just think about it bending, and then set it down. And just 10 minutes or so, we'll just pick it up. And then I set it down, and we were in this conversation. We're kind of laughing and joking, and the comfort with all of us around the table, and we all have all these stories. It was really rapid-fire stuff. And I, at one point, I looked down at the table, and there was the fork, and I just picked it up, and without any effort at all, just bloop, it just was like, it was like bending silly putty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I did it again. I was like, I did it once here, and we did the same thing, bloop, bloop, and it bent again. So I did two forks within, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, and there was no effort at all, except for ignoring the fork, I think, was the biggest thing.
Yeah, I think so. I for me, it literally had to, I had to get out of my own way, I think. Because honestly, I was trying both before and after, like really trying to like bend, you know, put it into a pretzel. And I guess I could have hurt my hands and done it, but without hurting myself, I could not do it. But there was that in-between moment where I just got in the zone or whatever. You just hit that zen space, whatever it is. And I was able to, you know, freely bend it and bend it pretty successfully. You know, the pretty sharp bends in them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it was, you know, honestly, I think there was just a playful vibe around the coffee table.
I think so.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bunch of new friends, and it was just, we were drinking wine. I mean, this was not like we were in some sort of like sacred space. I mean, we were kind of laughing and goofing off and drinking. And so something happened, and I just wanted to share that because I thought that was fun, and it was such a cool way to sort of just hang out around the coffee table. Now, did you start out doing Bigfoot research? Is that how you got into all this?
When I was a kid, like a little kid. And I was born in 1970, so a couple years, 3 years after the Patterson-Gimlin film is filmed, and As I'm Growing Up, In Search Of is on TV, and The Legend of Boggy Creek. And I hit that 1970s Bigfoot mania when I was a kid. And I loved the whole phenomenon. I remember there was one book in my elementary school library on Bigfoot, and I would get it out every single week and just read it again and again. So that was, I guess, my gateway drug in a way to all this. Although I was very interested in folklore as a kid, and I would not have known that's what it was called. To me, it was just ghost stories and monster stories and this and that. But I was very interested in these things. And if someone told me there was a haunted house somewhere nearby, I always wanted to go there. I always wanted to see it. I always wanted to hear all these stories. I didn't know that was called folklore at the time. It was just neat stuff to me as a kid. As I grew older and I got into actual folklore, I was like, oh, I've always loved this stuff. I just didn't know what it was called. But the odd thing is I didn't have really Bigfoot experiences. I saw a UFO when I was 8. And I'm guessing at that date, it seems right. I didn't write it down or anything. But my mom woke me up. I was asleep, and I remember my mother woke me up. She said, do you want to see a UFO? I mean, what 8-year-old boy is going to say no to that? You know, it's like, the answer was an absolute yes. And she took me downstairs and out in the driveway. I was with one of my brothers and my sister and my mom, I remember. And we were looking at this, what appeared to be a craft, a somewhat disc-shaped craft with lights that rotated around it. It was over top the trees, kind of on the horizon line. And the way I remember it is they got very bored after a while. I remember we watched it for, I want to say, half an hour or something like that. Just, it was just hovering. It was in place.
Half an hour?
That's how I remember it.
Wow, that's impressive.
A long time. We just sat there and watched it. And everyone else got bored. And they said, we're going in. And I wanted to watch it more. Now, this sounds strange, but I grew up on a farm. I had a very, very protective dog that was literally my best friend. He would not let anyone touch me or get near me. So, and I was kind of given free rein a bit at nighttime because my parents knew it was a safe place. But in any case, I remember them going inside, and I remember being in the driveway and watching this. And the next thing I remember is watching it from a window inside the house. I do not remember going inside. Now, again, I was young. It was a long time ago. But that is the sequence of events as I remember them. I remember being in the driveway watching this and then being inside the house watching from a window, the same UFO, whatever it was.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
But I wasn't super into UFOs. I was really into Bigfoot, you know? That was my thing.
So at that age, the big ape, is that what you were thinking? Big ape living in the woods?
Eight years old, I think so, yeah.
I don't think you think that way anymore. When did the change happen?
I had to gradually kind of work my way up to this stuff, honestly. In fact, when we were on Where Did the Road Go together, Sarai, that was the first time I ever talked publicly about any of my own experiences. And I didn't know if they really counted because I had this, you know, what I always call my sort of maybe abduction thing. And I didn't know because I thought,
the sort of maybe abduction thing is that's the showing up at the missing memory between the yard and looking out the window.
No, that happened later when I was in college. And I had talked about it on there and I said, you know, I don't know if it counts because I don't think I ever left my bed. And it was actually you who finally kind of made me relaxed and start talking about this a little bit more because you said, well, that's what I say about mine. Say, I don't think I ever left my bed. And then it kind of all started to click like, oh, wait, maybe there's more to this than I have been, you know, I just haven't been giving it enough weight, I suppose. And I started thinking a lot more about it and about these things and how they tie together. And even going back to some of my earliest memories were of what I thought was a recurring dream. When I was very, very young, I would wake up, house full of people. I could tell when anybody was up. I could hear my father downstairs, my father and mother. My mother would, you know, she'd make breakfast every day almost for everybody. I could hear her making breakfast if she was up. I could hear my father moving around and so forth. So this was before anyone was up. I could tell I'd wake up in the morning. And again, this is a recurring, what I thought was a dream and which now I give more weight to. And I could hear, for some reason, I never saw anything. For some reason, I decided it was three voices. And for years and years and years, as a kid, I thought there were three witches in my house. I could hear them. I thought the voices came from the room below me, below my bedroom. And I knew I had to be quiet because I didn't want them to know I was awake. And they would speak in this language I couldn't understand. And it for years and years, I just used to have this recurring dream about these three witches in my house. And then it was only after I started thinking about all this other stuff where I went, I wonder if, you know, because there was a series of books I read called Man, Myth, and Magic. They were in our local public library. And it's like an encyclopedia series of just weird stuff. And from a very young age, I got those books out. I would get one volume every week, start at A, go to Z, and repeat. And there was a lot of stuff about witchcraft and witches' Sabbaths and things like that in there. And I wonder if that kind of put that thought of them being witches in my head. But in any case, now I look back and I wonder, you know, here I'm waking up and I'm hearing voices and I'm unable to move as far as I remember. You know, it was a kind of sleep paralysis thing as a child. Which I don't know how unusual that is, but I remember just laying there just trying to be quiet, and drifting in and out of sleep, which, again, it was mirrored later in life when I had a more dramatic kind of abduction experience.
Okay, we'll get back to this, but we got sidetracked a little bit. You were treating Bigfoot in your own thoughts, in your mind. You framed Bigfoot as a big hairy ape that lived in the woods.
Yes.
And where are you at now? What would you call Bigfoot? I mean, what would you call the type of research you're doing?
The further I get into it, the more difficult it is for me to think of this phenomena, this Bigfoot thing, as A, separate from these other paranormal phenomena we talk about, and B, as simply a undiscovered primate or a relic hominid or whatever the fashionable phrase of the moment is for trying to describe them as natural creatures. I mean, if I have to put a label on it, I think whatever these things are the same things our ancestors were talking about when they were talking about earth spirits, earth whites, they would have been called in Germanic folklore, trolls maybe, these same kind of folkloric entities that we've been talking about in every culture, not just Germanic culture. I'm just a lot more familiar with that than some other mythology. But everywhere, all over the world, we've been talking about these wild men that live in the woods next to us. And in almost no culture are they considered natural animals. There's a few First Nations tribes, I believe, that consider them natural, but they are by far in the minority. Most of the cultures everywhere consider them to be some sort of supernatural being or a witch or somehow tied to fairies or the other in some way.
And by the other, what do you mean by the other?
It's just a generic catch-all term for these, I don't know, for everything that we can't explain. That, again, I think it all seems so tied together. You know, Joshua Cutchin and I are working on this book, and we've tied poltergeist phenomenon and all manner of other, you know, strange lights, mystery lights. We've tied this all to the Bigfoot phenomenon with ease. You know, it hasn't been difficult. We have two volumes on this stuff coming out. So I can't tell you how it's related. I just think it's related. And I just say the other as a sort of generic catch-all for that unknown that we're trying to figure out. We're trying to understand more about.
There's a fellow that I've talked with. I'll use only his first name, Doug. He told a remarkable story, I believe from Pennsylvania. No, it was from Pennsylvania, and which is most of your research is focused on Pennsylvania. And well, he's had a lot of direct UFO contact, very solid, credible, thoughtful, reasonable character. So like a believable person telling an unbelievable story. So he has lots of UFO contact experiences. And he has a Bigfoot experience where he was at a little cabin in the forest in Pennsylvania, and he was lying on the couch, which was right next to the window, this big picture window. And in the middle of the night, he heard something standing outside the picture window, and he sensed it was like an alien presence, but he wants to call it Bigfoot. And he said this thing pounded on the window so hard. And he talked about this, and I was like, wait a minute, if he pounded on this window that hard, why didn't the window break? And he didn't really have an answer to that. And that's something that's shown up in my research a few times, where things have pounded on the window so hard, and the witness will say something to the effect of, I don't understand why the window didn't break. And I have had that experience with Andrea. It happened twice in one night. When we were talking about some very powerful UFO-type stuff, we were like wrestling with very powerful UFO angst-ridden personal experiences that we were trying to express ourselves. And at that moment, bam, something hit the window so hard, I don't understand why the window didn't break. Happened twice as we were talking about this. Once at night and then the next morning, where we basically said, wasn't it weird when that window made that loud noise? And then bam, it happened again right as we were saying that. Now, so I have a Bigfoot story and then people talking about UFOs and then the same pounding on the window phenomena that shows up.
We get a lot of reports of, you know, I'll get a call from a Bigfoot witness, for instance. And I do active investigation, so I like to go out and put boots on the ground and see where they saw it. And I'll get there as soon as I can. I got a call 2 weeks ago. I was out there within 2 days. I want to get there as soon as possible, see what they saw, be where they saw it. And I'm lucky because I have the freedom to do that. And often people will tell me, and this is usually people who have repeat encounters. In other words, where they say these creatures are coming onto their property for one reason or another. And they will say, they get up and they run across my roof. I could hear them running across my roof at night sometimes. And I look at some of these houses, and one of them has been a trailer. And I'm thinking, really? A 1,000-pound, 9-foot-tall creature is getting up on your roof and running across to the point where you say you hear it running across, and it's not leaving a mark. It's not leaving any damage. It's not denting the roof. It's not breaking tiles off. Not that I doubt them for a second. I'm just saying it mirrors again that sort of banging on the window where there's no damage to the window.
You and I could go on and on and on and on. We are going to take our very first break. For free Dreamlanders, you will be hearing a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
You think that what subscribers to UnknownCountry.com get is just an archive or a rehash of what you can hear for free? Not quite true. Listen to this.
The Indonesian doctor is writing an article in the 1980s. This is more than 10 years after the mysterious German doctor has died. And now he's writing his recollections of that whole episode. And one of his recollections was that there was a small boy at one time when he first met the doctor in the island of Sumbawa. There was a small American boy living with him.
And that small American boy may very well have been the son of the mysterious doctor that Peter Lavenda is talking about. A special interview called Adolf Hitler in Asia. That boy went on to grow up, to come to the United States, to become a horrendous anti-Semite and serial killer. He was executed in Indiana in 2010. I'm telling you, you don't hear this anywhere else. Nowhere else. So come on, get on the stick. Become a subscriber to UnknownCountry.com. I guarantee you there is incredible information in our subscriber area, and we need you to keep supporting this. It's important. There's no place like it. No other website offers you the amazing riches of unusual and extraordinary information that we do. Subscribe today.
Ever wonder which Whitley Strieber books are available and where you can get them? Now you can go to Whitley Strieber's dedicated book website, Strieber.com, and shop for every Whitley Strieber item that's available. Many of them are available in electronic form, as well as hardcover and paperback. Experience the magic of transformation, the insights of breakthrough, the joy of miraculous journey. Join Whitley on the wondrous journey of that is his life. Thrill to his fiction, the magic of Orenda, the startling power of Alien Hunter, and so much more. Go to Strieber.com now and explore.
We are back on The Unseen, and I am talking with my friend, author Timothy Renner, about his Bigfoot research, and the Bigfoot research that sort of overlaps into all kinds of other stuff. Just before the break, he was talking about Bigfoot running across people's roofs, the roofs of their home, and that seems like a fairly common thing, and I think I have a few stories about people who say, oh, the owls were on the roof. I could hear them on the roof. I could hear them walking around on the roof. Now, owls pretty little. And so one woman did say, yes, she had a metal roof, and she knew they were owls, and they were loud. And I'm like, wow, owls are loud walking? And she said she knew they were owls. And this is what she told me. She's saying, oh, there's owls on the roof. They're making a lot of noise. Suddenly, there's a glowing, shining lady in white standing in her room.
Ooh.
And then the woman says, here, I'm going to take you to up into outer space. I can't remember exactly how it played out, but all of a sudden she was, I don't think there was any craft involved. It was just suddenly they were floating in outer space looking at the Earth. And there was like, they could see this force field, this kind of energetic force field around the Earth. And the woman said, that's there to trap you in. We're not letting you out. And then whoosh, she was back in the bed.
Wow.
So there's no UFO in there. There's no owls in there. But she said it was sounded like owls. Now, I sent her a picture of another witness. He's been open about this. His name is Christopher Bledsoe. He has seen this woman that he calls the Shining Lady. And he had a friend do a painting of this woman. And I sent the painting to the woman over email. And she got back to me right away and was like, oh, my God, that is exactly the woman I saw. Now, again, she's hearing owls on the roof. There's no, she doesn't see owls. She says, oh, there are owls on the roof. That why would it could be anything. But she said in her mind, she very clearly pictured them as owls. So the way I try to wrestle with this stuff is that it is very, very difficult to come up with anything concrete. And I am comfortable treating these events as a campfire story and just letting the story stand on its own. And then afterwards, you can speculate a little bit and you can see some similarities here and there. But I'm very cautious to read too much into these stories because there's an absurd quality to them that you must recognize.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it can be absurd. It can be, it's almost as if it's baked in to make the witness seem unbelievable or, you know, as I hate to use crazy, but, you know, that is kind of what the term that many people looking into the paranormal from the outside, you know, they throw that around a lot. You know, witnesses are crazy. You get that quite often. And there seems to be something baked into the experiences that almost kind of aids in that perception from the outside, I should say.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. And my sense is, and you and I have talked about this too, is there's something deeply personal tied into some of these. It's like, wow, like that was tailored to you and to you alone. And I've had that experience myself where I've had events that seem like, wow, I am the only person who could play detective and could have untangled this knot, partially out of my own obsessive nature in a way, but just the events took place in ways that seemed specifically created, stage managed for me and me alone. And I'm certain you've seen that also.
Oh, absolutely. To the point where it becomes difficult to explain sometimes, because as a writer, as someone who tells stories on my podcast, you have to kind of make these things into a linear story so people can understand them, but they're anything but. It's a cobweb. It's not a straight line. And it's very, very difficult to make a sequence of events that, in a, you know, make it into a linear story that people can understand. You know, this happened, then this happened. I end up telling these stories and saying, okay, but go back 2 days and then this other thing happened. And then it ties into something that happens 2 weeks later. And it's, you know, they're just not neat little stories that you can just tie up with a bow and present. They're messy and they're extremely personal to the point where sometimes I'll have things and they're just world shaking to me, and you tell other people and they just kind of look at you like, okay, you know, that's an interesting coincidence. And I'm you know, of course I'm no, it's so much more than that.
Anne Streber used to say something. She had a BS detector, and she said, I know when people are making up a story and it's not real, because if it's not weird, I don't trust it. Like, so if you had someone make up a story, a UFO story, they would probably say something very logical, like, oh, like I, you know, this event happened and I saw the UFO land and then I watched this little people get out and then they got back in and the UFO flew away. That is not what you hear. I've never used the term baked in, but I get it perfectly. That stuff that is baked in is so absurd that the witness themselves. Like, I think I'm out of politeness. I think a lot of people don't share the really weird stuff.
Yes. Yes. Oh, absolutely. And possibly more so. I shouldn't say that. But in my experience, more so with the Bigfoot reports, because I think people are much more comfortable with the idea of this being some kind of unidentified primate. It sounds less weird than being a big I don't know, or like I'm, you know, I'm comparing it to some sort of earth spirit or, you know, the wild man archetype I talk about a lot, these sort of weirder concepts. It's much easier to talk about an undiscovered primate. And the witnesses will often leave out weird stuff and I let them tell their whole story. And then when we get to the end, I say, okay, where are the weird lights? And they'll look at me and they'll pause and they'll say, well, I did see these orbs in the woods, you know, over there, and et cetera, et cetera. Or I saw a UFO one night. And then I say, where are the haunted houses around here? And an incredible number of Bigfoot witnesses have just turned around and told me right away, oh, my house is haunted.
And UFO witnesses will say the same thing. That's very normal. That's, or you know what's very normal and common in people who have UFO contact experiences, lifelong contact experiences, they'll say, oh, I grew up in a haunted house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's to the point now where I expect it from stories. Again, especially with witnesses who have multiple experiences, again, with these, you know, I'll call them creatures, but whatever they are, coming onto their property, the weird stuff follows. And that's the stuff that I absolutely love. You know,
Oh, yes.
I'm very interested in the creature reports too, but I like the weird stuff.
Oh yes. And I go back to the term campfire story. And I mean, do you use that term to describe these things at all? Cause I certainly do. I don't know if.
No, but I took one from Joshua Cutchin again. And he said, at some point he said, I wonder if this isn't all just one big ghost story, meaning all these things are just some part of, you know, one big ghost story. And I have used that before because I think it's a similar way of putting it.
I mean, campfire story is like sort of an open-ended term, right? So like a novel, I think it was Jim Mars said, you know, like, you know, writing fiction is really hard because he was doing all kinds of research into the paranormal and stuff and conspiracies. He said, writing fiction is really hard because fiction has to make sense. Right? So you write a novel, it's got to have a beginning, middle, and end. You got to tell a story, but these are like outside the boundaries of simple stories. And that's what a campfire story is. A campfire story is you can tell around the campfire and it's late at night and it can be just a spooky open-ended thing, and it's not a story in the classic definition. It doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end like we want. And I think that's why a lot of documentary filmmakers struggle with this stuff. And I've talked to a lot of documentary filmmakers and they say, oh, yeah. I said, what about this? And I said, oh, yeah, we had that as part of the thing, but we couldn't put it in. It was too weird. And I'm like, ugh. I think people self-edit their own stories exactly as you said. So you use the term wild man archetype. What does that mean?
It's as hard to define as it sounds. And I'm not super well-read on Jung. You know, I'm familiar with the concepts.
No one is super well read on Jung. I mean, Carl Jung wrote, like, he could stack up the stuff he wrote and it would like fill up a full library. So someone says they're well read on Jung, it's a bottomless pit to try to really read all his stuff.
But in any case, the wild man archetype is this idea that again, I've been playing with, that maybe we need this thing, whatever it is, this wild man of the woods, in the way that we need these other aspects of ourselves, the spiritual things that take the form, you know, of these different symbols and entities and so forth. And I think it's really well expressed in the way the wild man has changed. Part of what I've done in some of my books is I've just collected these old newspaper stories, which I believe they're talking about Bigfoot. And they, in the 1800s, they called them wild men. Around 1900 or so, people become familiar with the mountain gorilla from Africa. So the reports change and they start calling them gorillas. Sometime around 1930, 1940, monster movies get big and the reports in the newspaper turn to monsters. They start calling them monsters. But the look of the wild man has changed. Now, I used to put this up to Victorian writers and editors of newspapers, perhaps being a little too prudish about naked men running around in the woods. And now I've actually started to wonder if that's not the case, because a greater number of these reports from the 1800s have these big hairy things clothed or partially clothed. They'll be wearing a ripped up shirt or some form of clothing, or they'll be carrying an old rusty musket that doesn't fire but is still identifiable as a musket. And if you look at the way UFOs have changed, you know, in the late 1800s, they were airships and they were kind of dirigibles or what we would later become known as dirigibles with weird lights on them. Then in the 50s, they take the form of these sort of Art Deco sci-fi things. And in the 70s, we start getting the black triangles. And nowadays, we get a lot of reports of, you know, plasma and things that look like jellyfish. And, you know, the UFO seems to have changed culturally what we see. The wild man seems to as well. And I wonder if the further we get away from nature as a society, if our wild man hasn't gotten wilder. So in medieval times, the wild man is depicted often carrying a staff. He's more like a wizard. He may be covered with hair, but the wild man is always dangerous, but he was less animal-like. He could talk to animals. He was that in between us and nature. And then by the time you get to the 1800s, you know, like I said, you get some of these reports of these half-clothed, hairy things running around the woods, but they're still identifiable as men. And then today we just have a big wild gorilla that's out there. And I wonder if our wild man hasn't changed in the way that UFOs have.
That in some sense that our distancing from the forest has created a more forest-like being.
Yes. Yeah, as we need, if it's our connection to the forest or whatever, this wild man, this in-between, you know, between the wild and us, as we've gotten further away, has the wild man by necessity, in a sense, gotten wilder, you know?
I understand your argument beautifully, yes. Hey, we are at the half-hour mark. We need to take our second break. And for free Dreamlanders, you are going to hear a few commercials. For paying members, we will be right back.
Say yes to Serious Wonder. Unknown Country offers so much. Free Dreamland, a free weekly newsletter, free daily news, a thriving free message board. But it all depends on you becoming a subscriber. And you get so much more. Dreamland and special interview archives going back years. Vintage Dreamland from the broadcast days. Live chats with our extraordinary guests. So say yes to Serious Wonder. Click on that subscribe tab on Unknown Country today.
The key, the mystery, the wonder. Now in a powerful new edition from Tarcher Penguin, Whitley Strieber updates the thrilling story with new revelations. Even the master of the key's most incredible predictions are coming true. We've discovered that there are many universes besides our own. He predicted this in 1998. He described how intelligent machines could be built. We're doing it now. If you love The Key, you need this new edition. And if you've never read it before, don't miss this beautiful book filled with true wisdom and true revelations. The Key is unique in this world. Graham Hancock says, "Consider its messages, and you'll find it has worked a kind of magic on you." The Key, a selection of the Quality Paperback Book Club, the Book of the Month Club, and the One Spirit Book Club. Available in paperbacks everywhere and online in all ebook formats.
There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and UnknownCountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
We are back on The Unseen with Timothy Renner, and just before we took our break, we were talking about the forest and how we have... modern man, present-day man, has broken away from the forest. Now, I'm going to ask you, that term, what does that mean to you, the forest?
Well, I mean, the forest is full of mystery and possibility, and it's, I think part of the reason I love Bigfoot research so much is it just gives me another excuse to get out there. But I think because I grew up around the woods and I spent my youth in the woods. I mean, I would wake up in the morning and just go and just, you know, I'd pack myself a little lunch and just wander through the woods all day. It always kind of held that sort of mystery and possibility for me, and I've loved it from, you know, as long as I can remember. I've just been in love with the woods. So for me, it's just this mystical place where we commune with possibility.
Yeah, and I mean, I just think of the forest, the wilderness. I mean, that's where Jesus went, right? So he went into the wilderness. He went in for 40 days. And so there's this place of testing.
Yes. Well, Merlin too. And Merlin, there was a great battle that Merlin felt responsible for. And he saw a lot of young men die. And he just went off into the forest. And that's when he learned to talk to the animals and so forth. And very interestingly, they call that Merlin's wild man phase. So that ties into everything. But it's a very similar story.
Oh, how interesting. And he came out with a big beard. And yeah. And dressed as, I'm not sure if he was dressed as a wizard. I'm going right to the Disney movie where he had a pet owl that spoke, that talked, named Archimedes, I think. I'm not sure. I think that was in the name Archimedes came from T.H. White's A Sword in the Stone.
I believe so.
You tell a story of playing chess in the woods, in the forest. I would love to hear that story.
Yeah, that was my wife's name for it. I grew to use that name myself, but it was my wife's name for it. She said, you know, you're playing chess with someone out there. She's much more skeptical than I am. I go into this thing with, you know, I'm ready to believe, I suppose. And for a while, I did think it was people. So what happened was I was hiking, and at a trailhead, I found, and this is a very populated park. This isn't way out in the middle of nowhere. This is, you know, a county park. It's a large county park. And it's not a very popular one. It's in an area called Hex Hollow. And not a lot of people go there because there are some, you know, there's some legends and so forth associated with the ghost stories and stuff. But it's one of my favorite places to hike, mostly because it's, you know, 10 minutes from my house. I can get there quickly. I was hiking there one day, and at a trailhead, I found all of this white quartz. Just bright, bright white quartz. And it looked like someone or something had been sitting there and just smashing it on a boulder nearby. And they were smashed into splinters. And I said, oh boy, isn't that interesting? Like, I wonder why or what was happening here. And they were stacked in a very simple cairn, a simple arrangement of stones. And I, for whatever reason, just intuitively, I was like, I stacked them up, made a different stack. And
how tall are we talking about here? Like,
as I found them, it wasn't tall at all. And then I think I stacked them much, you know, probably two or three times what was stacked there.
And how high would that about?
It was maybe two or three stones high.
So, I mean, inches or feet or?
Oh, I'm thinking 6 inches maybe.
Okay. Got it. Okay.
So not huge stones. They were small, and they were arranged in a triangle. So three stacks of stones in a triangle, and each stack might have been just two stones high. And there, like I said, there was a bunch of splinters around, like something that had just been smashing these. So I made a different arrangement, and happened to come back a week later, and it was changed. Oh, that's interesting. Changed it again. Came back maybe a week or two after that. At this point, I'm not sure what's going on. And I'm thinking it's probably a person at this point. Just logically, like I said, this isn't out in the middle of nowhere. I didn't think it was anything necessarily weird going on, but it's a fun little game. Like, it keeps getting changed. So I changed them again. Now I got more interested. So I started going at least once a week, usually two or three times a week. And every time it would be changed. This carried on for months. And I was taking pictures, and I would tell my wife about it. She said, well, you're playing chess with someone. There's someone out in the woods, or someone else is there as much as you are, and they're just changing it And, you know, when they're there, it's, well, yeah, probably, but it's still very interesting that they're taking the time to do this. And at some point in the fall of that year, I was with my wife and kids, and we were hiking there. And I said, oh, I'm going to run up to my chessboard and change it around. I'll meet you guys back on this other trail. So I ran up and did it, met them back where we said we'd meet. And my wife said, oh, I want to go see your chessboard. I want to see this. So, okay, so walk back up the hill. And I'd been gone for maybe 15 minutes, at this point. I changed it and met her and walked back, maybe 15, maybe 20 minutes at the most. And when I got back, everything was the same, except there was a great big leaf under one of my stacks of stones. And I did not put that leaf there. No way, no how, and leaves don't fall under rocks. And I just went, that really made me take a step back. And I was literally kind of looking around in the woods, like, does someone live, you know, this close? And are they just like spying on me when I change it? Like, how did this happen that quickly? And I just decided at that point, you know, something weirder here is going on. I should say that I made my stacks more complex. And my thought was, if this was another person, like if I was doing this, I would match the complexity of what the other person was doing, or at least I would try or play off of what they were doing in some way. But every single time they were moved, the stones were moved into this triangle. So there'd be just stones at the point of each point of the triangle. So it was simplified every time, but changed and usually changed in the same way. Sometimes it would be knocked over. It'd be very messy. It wouldn't look like anything. But most times it was changed to this very simple triangle pattern. This goes on throughout the fall and into the winter. And I became convinced that, you know, again, that if someone was doing this, they have to be there as often as I am. And now I'm visiting, you know, two or three times a week. And it's just changing every time. And I'm very, very fascinated in this. And it was a January day. And there was a little bit of snow on the ground, just a light covering of snow. There was no one else in the park. I parked and I went up there. And as I'm walking up the hill, there's a very large murder of crows that lived in the trees. And I was there so often that they were used to me. They didn't panic. They would announce me whenever I was there. They called it and sort of announced me. But this day, for whatever reason, they just went nuts. I remember that. And they came out of the trees and they flew right over my head. Like I could have, if I lifted my walking stick up in the air, I could have knocked one out of the air. That's how close they flew to my head. And just the whole murder of crows just threw, they were all calling. And I thought, oh boy, that's weird. But you know, it didn't, not necessarily scary. I just thought, you know, usually I don't scare them. They usually just sort of announce me. So I walk up and I get to the area that my wife called my chessboard. And I'm rearranging the stones and I'm hit with this really heavy, heavy smell of dead animal kind of mixed with skunk. And, you know, this is January. It's not like the middle of summer where dead stuff, you know, you can smell real heavy, real easily. And I'm kind of like, what is this? On my way up, I had heard what sounded like, in my mind, sounded like something knocking two rocks together from coming from the opposite direction from behind me. I went to look, I couldn't see anything, proceeded up. The smell happens, and then I hear what sounds like a wood knock, something, you know, swinging a baseball bat and hitting a tree from the other direction. And right about that time, as I'm, and this all happens very quickly in succession, I'm hit with the smell, I hear the wood knock, and the hair on the back of my neck just goes up. I hike alone in the woods often. I'm not terribly afraid. I usually, certainly this park, I'd hike there a million times by myself every time of the year. I knew every trail. And for some reason, I just got so scared. Like I've said before, I would have run if I could have, but my knees locked up. I was that afraid. And if I hadn't had my walking stick to lean on, I probably would have had to sit down. And there wasn't anything to be particularly scared of. It just, this fear just came over me. And I'm sitting there shivering, and I, you know, I've read enough Bigfoot reports to know these are all things that happen, you know, and then people tend to see creatures. And I'm thinking, well, this is what you're here for. Like, try to man up and you're going to get your sighting, it seems like. And I'm really, really just literally shivering. I was so frightened at this point. And then I heard three clicks. It sounded like little gears, not big, massive gears. It sounded like little metal gears. Click, click, click. Came from the same direction that I heard the wood knocks come from. And it was almost in an instant. When I heard that sound, the smell went away. The fear went away. Everything went back to normal. I was able to, you know, restack the rocks and kind of gather myself and look around a little bit. I didn't get up the nerve to go all the way in the direction where I heard the knocks and the gear sound from, but I went a few steps in that direction to see if I could see anything. And just kind of made my way out of there. On the way out, I saw, now I've never run into really clear footprints anywhere I've been. I've never had that kind of luck. I find what I call maybe footprints a couple times, and this was one of those times in that very light coating of snow. And this could have been there on the way up and I didn't notice it. I don't know if I just was more observant on the way down because of what had happened, if I was looking for things. But there seemed to be very large foot-shaped impressions in the snow, about 16 inches long, that came off of a game trail and across the path and then into a cornfield where I couldn't follow them. The ground was just too rough. Couldn't follow them anymore. But they seemed to come across the path, and they seemed to be about a 4 to 5 foot stride. So a pretty big stride in between these pretty large maybe tracks. Again, I couldn't see toes. They were just foot-shaped in that very light coating of snow. So I don't know if that was a thing or not, but it certainly got my attention. That was the strangest day, and to Soraya from Where Did the Road Go and Joshua Cutchin's credit, you know, I had kind of said that's a, you know, it's a Bigfoot experience until they kind of, when I told them the story, and they said, well, if that would have happened in a house, you would have called that a poltergeist experience. You didn't see a creature. And that really kind of opened my eyes. You know, I don't know what it was. I just know what happened. The chessboard exchange continued for some months after that into the spring until I cut myself on the quartz. It was very, very sharp. Some of the pieces of quartz, I cut myself and I bled all over the rocks. I just, you know, it was just one of those cuts that just kept bleeding and bleeding. And I thought, well, this is really going to stir things up. This will really, you know, make things happen now. And it kind of killed it. It never really happened, never really changed again.
So when you went back the next time, the rocks were all still in the same position?
Still in the same position. And, you know, I tried several times after that, and it sort of killed the experience for whatever reason. The spot was dead after that. They stopped changing.
Here's a question for you. Were you at the point when you wanted it to stop, or you felt like this had run its course?
I don't think so. I think I would still be doing it today if it, you know, had kept changing.
How interesting. Yeah, how interesting. I mean, I'm just thinking of a wise teacher. Like, if you do the same thing over and over and over and over again, the wise teacher is going to eventually have to say, enough, move on.
Yeah, well, yeah. I didn't think of it like that. And maybe the cut, in a sense, was, you know, not the lesson from the teacher, but the teacher going, okay, this is the lesson. You know, you've cut yourself here, and that's that.
Fascinating. Now, how far was this away from the main trail?
This was right at a trailhead. I mean, so it absolutely, you know, up to the point where I found that leaf under it 15 minutes later, I could easily think that, you know, this is a person doing this. And some of the changes may have been people, you know. I don't think all of them were. That's the only thing I could say.
And so you could actually see the rocks right from the trail. You're walking down the trail, you could just see the rocks.
Yeah. Yeah, you could, especially if you were looking for them. They were probably 5 feet into the woods, maybe.
Very interesting. In one of Whitley's books, it was in the communion letters. He wrote about, he said, you know, he was seeing patterns of people seeing owls, people seeing dead relatives, and ritualized knocking was another thing that, people were seeing or hearing. So I think I've got that right. It's in, I remember quoting that at some point. So the ritualized knocks, that's something that shows up in the UFO contact lore. Very common.
And Bigfoot and poltergeist as well.
Yeah. Yes. So what are we dealing with? Like we're dealing with a spokes on a wheel, right? So all these spokes, one spoke is the UFO experience, one spoke is Bigfoot, one spoke is poltergeist, one spoke is the near-death experience, one spoke is shamanic initiation. And what are all those spokes connected to? That's what I want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what the term I use the other for, you know, just that. Or maybe the other is the entire wheel, I should say. I use it for, but yes, why, you know, are they the same thing in video game terms? Are we skinning these things with different skins, you know, like in video game terms, we'll say, you know, that's just the same thing with a different skin on it. You know, it looks different, but it's the same. It acts the same. It has the same programming. Are these the same things with different skins, or are these different things that are somehow related?
When you spoke at that conference, you told a beautiful story. There's on the cover of your book, the book is titled Don't Look Behind You, which is your most recent book. There's an illustration you did that was taken from a photograph of a deer skull propped on a stick?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was impaled on a branch at eye level.
Tell me the story of that. That was remarkable. Or tell the listeners. I already know this story, but this was a remarkable story.
So there's a place called Toad Road that is around here, and that I spend a lot of time digging into. There's a lot of local folklore about it, and I've met a lot of people who have had strange experiences there. I wrote my first book all about it, and I never thought I'd get a second book out of it, and Don't Look Behind You it's sort of about it. It's also about my experiences while I'm looking into this stuff, but it has a great deal to do with that area. And I was out there with a friend one day. It was in April, and we walked in. I'm very strange. I'm a completist in some ways, and I can't just do half the road. I like to walk the entire thing a couple times a year. I try to do it. And it's all private land. No one should be back there. I have permission to be back there.
And this is on Toad Road itself. So you're walking the actual Toad Road. Okay.
It got washed out in Hurricane Agnes, which was 1972, and it's been closed since then. So I was hiking it with a friend. It was, you know, April, and we'd gone in, I don't know, maybe a mile. The whole road is maybe 2.5 miles at the longest. It's not, some people have reported it's 9 miles long or something like that. It's not, it's maybe 2.5-3 miles. So we'd hiked maybe half of it.
So wait a minute, you've gotten two books out of a road that's 2.5 miles long?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, keep going.
Yeah, there was a lot there. And two interesting things happened this day. One of them I almost forget about telling because the other thing kind of ties in so well with the other skull. But we ran into a wall of stink, which smelled exactly like that smell I was talking about earlier, like something dead mixed with skunk, mixed with garbage. Very, very sickening kind of smell. But it was like a wall across the trail. You could literally walk through it, smell it, and walk out of it and not smell it, and then walk back into it and smell it again. It was very, very strange. So there's a few feet of the trail with a wall of this smell that you could walk through. So that happens. And then on the way out, I look down, and right in the middle of the path is a perfectly clean raccoon skull. Now, I've collected animal skulls. I'm an artist like you. I like to draw them. I've been drawing them since I was a kid. I've been collecting them since I was a kid. But I won't pick up gory ones if they have any gore or dead matter still on them. I tend to leave them be. But if they're clean, if they're, you know, sun bleached, you know, I usually pick them up and put them in my pack and like, wow. So I mean, I am particularly tuned to that color in the woods. I tend not to miss it. I'll pick them out and people are like, wow, where'd you, how did you see that? I've just, well, I've been, you know, looking for them my entire life. I'm just kind of tuned to that color. So the fact that I missed it going in is possible, but it seems very unlikely to me that it would be right in the middle of the trail and I would miss this perfectly clean raccoon skull. But there it was on the way out. I picked it up, put it in my pack, neat, you know, and off we go. And because I'm a completist, like I said, I made the plans to meet him back there in a week. And because I want to finish, I want to do the whole thing, do the whole hike. And it's out and back, basically. So we made plans to come back. And, you know, a week went by, he couldn't make it. Another week went by, he couldn't make it. So it's third week. So we're into, you know, the time of year where things are really grown up now. And it's getting less and less likely that we're going to be able to hike it. It gets pretty impassable down there. Like I said, cause it's not a hiking trail. It's no one really should be there. So, I said, well, I'm just going to do it by myself. No big deal. He can't make it. So I go out there and there's a certain way I have into the road, that I found, my son actually found it. It's the very, very oldest part of the road from the 1700s that most people don't even know is there. And we were just out there one day and my son just was like, Dad, look. And he found this like amazing section of the road with the stonework from the 1700s is still there. It's like, wow, I can't believe this is here. So that's the way I go in. I go in this way that no one else does. And I go in that way and I get to about the spot where I found that raccoon skull on the trail and I hear a sound up ahead, just enough to make me look up. And I saw something and I cannot tell you what it was. It was very large and it was quadrupedal. So it wasn't on two legs. It was gray and black, sort of gray in the center of its back and kind of faded out to, you know, blacker hair on the outside. And it was quick and silent. It was faster than anything I've seen in the woods in Pennsylvania, and it was quiet. It didn't make a sound going through the brush, and it moved south. So I was hiking southward on the trail / road. Not much of a road anymore. It's barely a trail in most places. It's really, really overgrown. And so it moved south. So it moved away from me. I can't tell you what it was. I saw it for a second, maybe at that. The thought that came into my head, bizarrely, was moose. And the only reason I'm saying that is I had seen a moose. I was hiking in Massachusetts and I saw a moose one time.
Wow, you saw a moose in Massachusetts. It's not impossible, but that's impressive.
Yeah, it was out towards the western part. I remember it was the gate that was, you know, having grown up on a farm and having seen, you know, horses and cows and stuff. And you kind of think, you know, moose maybe moves like a horse, and they don't. They have this sort of different gait to them. And I remember just like how odd. I remember thinking like, wow, that's not a horse. it's more impressive than a horse. But the reason I said that came to my mind, I think, is because the gait was so weird. It's just such a weird gait this thing had. It wasn't like a deer. It wasn't, you know, bounding like a deer. It's just this weird gait, but very, very quick. So not out of bravery. I wasn't being brave. In fact, I sat down later in the day and thought, you know, if something was trying to lead you, you took the bait, you followed it. You know, what were you doing? You were alone, something really big, and you just took off after it as fast as I could. It was almost like I was in a trance. I don't remember too much of the hike going after it, other than there was mud. It was very, very muddy, and there were areas I had to kind of navigate around, like huge, huge mud puddles, just so I didn't get stuck. Again, this is right by a creek.
And so as someone who's familiar with this kind of thing, if there was, you were in a muddy place and you were tracking a moose, boy, the moose, I'd leave a very, very, very defined footprint.
Right. Yeah, anything would have. On the way back out, I looked for prints, but at this point I was just focused on going. and moving as quickly as I could in the direction that this thing went. It was very trance-like. And I just remember navigating some of these big mud areas that I had to, I would have gotten stuck in them. But other than that, I just remember just pushing through the brush and you know, a lot of the thorns and nasty stuff had grown up. But what stopped me in my tracks was this deer skull. And it was impaled at eye level, right in the middle of the trail. You could not miss it. There was no way you could miss it. And I just stopped in my tracks. I'm looking at this thing. And I've just noticed recently, and I did notice this at the time, and I didn't put any significance in it, but I was looking at the photos again recently. There was I don't know if they were dried flowers or there was some sort of plant matter placed on top of the skull approximately where the third eye would be, which I noted it at the time, and then I sort of forgot to mention it in the book, I think, when I wrote about it. But you can see it in the photos. So I took several photos of this because it's just like, wow, like this is really, really wild, because so someone or something with hands had to put it there. And if it was a person, they had to either bring a skull with them or find one and then decide to impale it at eye level. I just can't make it in my head work. You know, as I said, no one should be down in there. It's not impossible that they could be. But if they did, this is an amazing thing that sort of happened. And a lot of people have said, oh, that's, you know, you found a skull. Did you? Oh, that's a warning. And I've heard some of these other Bigfoot researchers say, yeah, they put skulls in the tree. That marks their hunting grounds. You better be careful. For whatever feelings are worth, the feeling I got from this 100%, and this wasn't mind speak, this wasn't a language that came into my head, this is just a feeling. The feeling I got was, so you like that little raccoon skull? Well, you're really going to like this. That was just the overall impression I got, was that, oh, you like that other thing? Well, here's a nice big one. You're going to really, really like this. And I did not finish my hike that day. I was too blown away by this. I did keep it. It went in my pack. I brought it home. And the really interesting thing about that is, and this has slowed down lately, the last few Bigfoot investigations I've been on, I've not found skulls. But for about a year after that, 70%, I would say, of Bigfoot investigations I went on, I would find skulls, and I wasn't crawling around in bushes looking for them. They were in very, very prominent places. My favorite example is I was called on one. A guy said he had seen two creatures on his property a couple of days before. I went, and they were across the pond, and I went across the pond. It was funny. He wouldn't even go over there. He's like, you're going over there? I was like, yeah, I'm going over there. And I did all the normal stuff, like, you know, I'm going to hold up my walking stick. You tell me how tall they were. You tell me, you know, stop me where they were standing, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, he stopped me where they were standing. I get the, you know, approximate height of what he saw. And whenever he's done, you know, giving me the details, I look down at my feet. So I'm standing, you know, according to him, exactly where the creatures were standing. I look down at my feet, and here's a perfectly clean deer skull just right at my feet, right where he said the creatures were standing. So it was things like that were happening, where I was just finding these skulls. Like I said, I've collected them since I was a kid. And after finding that skull, I got so many skulls where I found more in that year probably after that than I found my whole life previous to that. It got to be almost ridiculous, the number of skulls I was finding.
Did you ask them to stop putting skulls there for you?
I did not, but there's another story that may play into that, if you have time for it.
Oh, let's hear it.
So, in The Messengers, you tell a story of a woman, and I'm sorry, I forget her name, who said that whenever she wanted to see an owl, she would just sort of ask the universe, I'd like to see an owl today. It's a very kind of New Agey thing, and sometimes I feel silly doing these things, but I'm open to experiment with this stuff, and I'm open to playing with this stuff. So I've read The Messengers. This is shortly after I've read The Messengers, and I say, So this is one of those cobweb moments where I have to bounce back and forth a little bit. This all happens in a cluster, and I don't at this moment remember the order. I think I'd have to go back and look at my notes, but I decided to try this one day. I said, well, I'm going to, and I haven't had, at this point in my life, I haven't had owl stuff happen to me. In fact, I think I told you I had a distinct lack of owls in my life. I grew up on a farm, and I remember being very upset. We had a barn and no owls in the barn. I was like, we have a barn. I want to see owls. And I think at this point in my life, I'd maybe seen one or two cross in front of the car at night, you know, in the headlights. But I read this story and I said, well, I'm going to try this, except, you know, I collect these skulls. I'm going to ask for antlers. I'm not going to ask for an owl. I'm going to ask for antlers. So I'm getting ready to go on a hike and there's no one around, so I don't have to feel embarrassed. And I just out loud, I say, I would like to find antlers today. And I start off on my hike. And maybe a quarter mile into the hike, not very long at all into the hike, I look over the side of the trail and I see something white. There's something white kind of blowing in the breeze. And it's 10 feet off the trail, something like that. And I'm very upset at this point because I think, sometimes we have some not nice hikers who leave diapers or, you know, they might clean up after their dog, but they don't take the bag of the dog mess home with them. So I'm thinking that's what it is. I'm thinking someone tied some trash or whatever up in a tree and it's sort of blowing, you know, in a plastic bag or something. So I'm going over to, cause I use the parks enough where I try to take out, you know, not only my own trash, but other people's. If I find it, I feel like, it's the least I can do. So I'm sort of upset, like, now I have to clean up this, whatever this garbage is.
Okay. So there's an altruistic thing that I've seen in these stories sometimes where someone has an altruistic moment. They're doing something kind, wanting no reward at all and not telling anyone. Just keep going.
So I get to this, you know, this white thing that was blowing, and what it was the entire tail section of a barn owl. The entire tail section, not one feather, the entire tail section of a barn owl that was pushed onto a little twig in this tree. How it was pushed onto that to stay there in the wind is amazing to me, how it didn't just blow right off. So I immediately realized, you know, here I asked for antlers and I got owls, you know. It just kind of stopped me in my tracks. It's like, whoa, I'm pretty sure this is the tail section of an owl. And I went home and looked it up, and indeed it was. It was it was the whole tail of a barn owl. White feathers is beautiful. So around the same time, I'd gone to an antique store, and there was a whole shelf of owls, like little ceramic owls. And I had no intention of collecting these things, but I'm looking at these and it says $1 each. There's this whole giant shelf of these things. Like, well, some of these are kind of neat. And I said, well, I'm just going to get one. I'm going to get one of these owls. And the one that sort of called to me was that it was a very kind of folk art. It was the only wooden one there. The rest of them were kind of ceramic painted, you know, very realistic looking. And this was a very kind of folk art version of an owl. So, I like that one. I'm going to get that one. It was about, you know, 6 or 8 inches high. It was bigger than the other ones, but you know, I can drop $1 on this. It's a neat little folk art owl. And I pick it up and I turn it over, and on the back of the owl is carved a wizard face. So yeah.
Merlin and his owl.
Yes, exactly. A couple of days after this, I'm hiking, and I should say, I'm writing these historical Bigfoot books. I'm illustrating nothing but Bigfoot, and I'm frankly getting tired of it. I do enjoy, you know, drawing Bigfoot, but draw one thing and one thing only for long enough, and you're gonna need a break, you know. So I was looking for something else to illustrate. I'm like, well, let me find something that's in the public domain, something I'd like to illustrate. And I came across it's called the Vita Merlini. It's the Life of Merlin. I'm like, well, that's neat, you know. And I had not made this wild man connection at all at this point. I just thought, oh, wizards, Merlin, this will be fun. Something completely different. That'll be fun to illustrate. I'll do that. Give me something else to do, you know, other than just drawing nothing but Bigfoot. So this is in the back of my head, and I'm on a hike, you know, a couple of days after finding this owl tailpiece, the same park, same time of day. And I'm going down a trail, and suddenly it hits me that you know, Merlin has this wild man phase, and how I can't kind of escape these wild men, and how, you know, this is connected to everything else I've been doing. And right as I have this thought, I hear it's just something big coming through the trees, like really pushing the trees. And it bursts out, and it's a barred owl. So not even a barn owl, not even the same kind of owl that I found the tail feather from. This is a barred owl. Comes right out in front of me and flies down the trail, like ahead of me, like in the direction I was going. Immediately as I had that thought, it just burst through the trees. And now I'm like, whoa, like what's going on with me and the owls now? And which I blame you for.
I take full responsibility. Well, which I don't. So I take partial responsibility. Let me put it that way. So something else is at play. It ain't me. But
right.
Thank you.
so now I'm having, you know, owl stuff happen, and at the same time I was getting another barred owl was outside my house. I remember from my patrons one time, I just stuck the microphone out the window. And like, you know, as I'm editing the podcast, I'm like, here's what's going on at my house, and just recorded, you know, owl sound for 5 minutes. I never saw that, but I heard them nightly. And then, you know, a little bit of time goes by, and this is after the chessboard incident. I had found another place. I'd found another cairn off the trail. And this one was interesting because I thought, I'm going to start playing again. And so this time, whenever I would stack stones on this, they would just be knocked down. Whatever was happening here, it would just be cleared off to the original. There were two, like, original very large stones in the crook of a tree. And whatever I would add to it would just be knocked off. It would always be just those two big stones. This is a good distance off the trail. Nobody can see this from the trail. So whatever's going on there is, you know, is more interesting, I guess, in terms of it possibly not being people. And I started leaving food offerings, which is, you know, maybe a no-no, maybe not. I'm reading folklore, and this is done in folklore. These are, you know, this is very common spirit offerings thing. And I kind of amped it up to alcohol offerings. And I left a little corked glass bottle of wine one day. Right in, so this cairn is kind of in the crook of a tree, and down below that there's a hollow in the tree that I can't fit my hand in. I guess a little kid could fit their hand in there, but I don't think an adult could. So I dropped this little bottle of wine in there, and I said out loud again, I would like a skull today. And I hiked about 10 minutes away from that, and I found this circle of trees again. I've been all over this park for years and years and years. I used to live on one side of it. Now I live on the other side. So it's been, as long as I've lived in Pennsylvania, it's been the closest park to me. So I've just hiked the entire thing. And for some reason, I never noticed this circle of trees. It's in the middle of a field, about maybe a quarter of an acre of trees. And I'm walking along, and I notice, like, why have I never been in there? Like, why have I never explored that area? That looks neat. So I headed right for it. And as I get inside the circle, I see little bits of fur. There's a pile of stones in the middle. Now, this is in the middle of a farm field. So, you know, it's probably just not anything mystical. It's probably where they just have been throwing the stones for 200 years or however long they've been farming this field. But it does make a pile of stones in the middle of a circle of trees, which, if it was in Ireland, would be considered a fairy fort. We're not in Ireland, so I've been told I can't call it that. But it would serve the same purpose.
You've been told by Joshua, I assume.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. So as I see this, you know, pile of stones in the middle, I'm heading up it, and I start seeing little bits of fur all around on the stones. And I'm looking, I'm like, huh, something's been killed here. And then about halfway up this pile of stones, I see a groundhog head, and it was freshly killed, and just the head, no body there, and the jaw was ripped off, and it was absolutely a fresh kill. So I asked for a skull, and I got a skull. The problem was it was covered in gore, and I did not take that. I didn't. Like I said, I don't like that. I'm not into gore and things like that. But I wasn't specific in the way I asked, I suppose. I asked for a skull and I got a skull. It was just covered in meat still. I backed out of this circle of trees and sort of, you know, kind of frightened, shocked that I was given what I asked for. You know, I realized it. I was like, wow, you asked for that. You got it. It's not the form that you thought it would take, but you certainly got a skull. And as I backed out of there, I kind of looked around and realized that I was at my chessboard. I'd sort of backed up to the area where that chessboard area was. Not only that, but that circle of trees would have been the area where I heard those wood knocks and that kind of gear sound coming from. So I didn't put that together at all until, you know, I had almost literally backed into the trailhead where my original chessboard was.
You are interacting with something.
Yes, no doubt.
Okay. Yes. And so I'm coming from the same, I feel like I've been interacting. It's calmed down greatly with the owl stuff. And part of the reason it calmed down, I'm convinced, is I asked it to. I went in the woods alone one time and I said, it's too much. You got to dial it down. I'm unsettled to the point where I can't do good work because you're freaking me out. And I said it basically like that, you know, like, thank you for all the owls. Now I get it. Back off. So when I said earlier, did you ask them to stop, you know, to giving you skulls? And that's, I had to ask to have the owls stuff slow down. And that was back in 2009, 10 years ago. So, and it has dialed down. And if I still get plenty of little owl winks, but I was getting hit over the head. So,
yeah. Well, there was some dark stuff that followed that. So folklorically speaking, I did a big no-no by not taking that. I asked for something. I was given a gift and I didn't take that. In folklore, that's a big no-no. That's if the other give, especially if you ask for it, if you ask for something and you're given it, you take it. And I did not. And the next, I visited the park a couple times after that. I look for the bottle of wine, by the way. I could see it where I dropped it in that the hollow of that tree. And the next time I went, it was gone. The time after that, it was back right where I left it. And the time after that, it was gone again. So I don't know what that was. Again, if it's a person, they've got small hands. They're able to reach in there and grab it, and they brought it back and then took it again. I don't know how that works. But about the third visit after that, my son and I were there, and I got attacked by a rabid raccoon. And there were so many synchronicities that surrounded this event that I just couldn't help but think there was something weirder than just a random raccoon attack. And I honestly have to wonder if I didn't offend something there by not taking the gift. I mean, it talks about that in folklore. And very as crazy as that sounds, I know it sounds wacky, but I cannot.
Nothing see. Sounds wacky. Yeah, this I get it. I totally follow this.
I cannot see it as a random event because of the sheer number of synchronicities that surrounded it, which would take a whole other show to get into. But yeah, it was some pretty dark stuff, and I pulled away from that area for a good long time. I'm just kind of getting back to hiking there again, where I feel I was hiking with a very good friend there. He had never been, and he wanted me to show him around, and we hike tons of other places. He had just never been there. And I was with him, and there was a horseshoe alongside the trail that just hanging on a branch that, again, this is just, you know, the feeling I got from it, you know, no mind speak, but the feeling I got from it was almost like an apology. It was almost like, we're good now. Like, you know, things are back to normal. But I kept away for a long time. I had very, very, you know, I consider that a very dark kind of repercussion of playing with this stuff.
Well, you're not only playing with this stuff, you're also documenting it. You have a remarkable podcast series. You have a really impressive outpouring of books. You're doing the illustrations for the books. So, yes, an amazing outpouring of I will say, creative energy. Because you're doing something, in my opinion, that I guess the soul of the artist would do. This is a creative endeavor. And I have to thank you for that. And I also, we went a little long here. I'm totally fine with that. This was worth doing. Yes, we need to have you back on, and because we are barely scratching the surface of the research you've done, as well as your own personal experiences.
I'm happy to come back anytime, Mike.
We'll have you back soon enough. Now, how do people get a hold of you?
The easiest way is strangefamiliars.com. Now, that's my podcast website, but all of that contact information goes to me. It's a one-man show, pretty much. So that's the easiest way for people to find me.
Timothy, thank you so much. This has been a delight.
Thank you, Mike.
This is Mike. I am chiming in after the editing. I just want to say thank you so much to Timothy. And once again, I encourage anyone who is listening to this to go listen to his podcast titled Strange Familiars. It's really remarkable. And I also want to say that during this episode, boy, I sure had to kind of bite my tongue. I felt like I wanted to answer every single one of his anecdotes, every single point in his stories, and say, oh yeah, I know just how that feels. Timothy and I are on very similar paths. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.